This podcast is a presentation of UCTV.tv, University of California Television. Like what you learn? Help others discover UCTV podcasts by leaving a comment or rating in iTunes.
I'd like to welcome you to Rady Children's and UCSD Department of Pediatrics Grand Rounds. This is also the 17th annual Lenore Lectureship. For those of you who don't know me, I'm Hal Hoffman. I'm Division Chief for Allergy, Immunology, Rheumatology, and Kawasaki Disease. So the Lenore Lectureship was established by Dr. Hamburger, Robert Hamburger, in 1999. This is actually a special year for this lectureship because Dr. Hamburger passed away in October. Told myself I wouldn't get choked up. He would have been 92 actually next on Monday, and he was a professor emeritus here at UCSD, and he was also one of the founding fathers of the UCSD School of Medicine back in the early 60s. He'll be remembered as an American hero, an astute clinician, an innovative scientist, a dedicated educator, a committed activist, a devoted philanthropist, and also a caring husband and father. After graduating from UNC, he became a pilot of a P-38 plane in World War II in the Air Force. And then after that, he attended Yale University for medical school and then served on faculty there before being recruited here in 1964 to join the really young UCSD campus. And he was then appointed assistant dean for the School of Medicine for 8 years. His research interests focused primarily on prevention and treatment of IgE-mediated diseases. He was the first chief of the Division of Pediatric Allergy and Immunology. That was between 1970 and 1990. And really, it was one of the preeminent training programs during that time in the country. So he was responsible for training dozens of allergist immunologists that are all over the country. And still is. I met him actually in 1994 when I was a fellow here. And at that time, he told me, after only knowing me for a few months, that I would be division chief one day. I told him he was crazy, but it happened. Robert and his wife Sonia, who's pictured here, were also real involved in music. They actually supported the chamber music series and have an endowment for that. And he also was continually active all the way up until just a few weeks before he died with education, both of medical students, residents, fellows, and actually was an attending here at Rady Children's. But Robert was also a real supporter of universal access to medical care. And he had a particular interest in health disparities in this country, particularly the African-American experience. In 1999, he established the Lenore Lectureship in memory of the wife of one of his first fellows, Mike Lenore, who actually died during Mike's fellowship of a severe asthma attack. So the lectureship now has two themes, and actually our speaker this year actually fits it better than most. The two themes are prevention, diagnosis, and treatment of asthma, allergy, and immunologic diseases, and also health disparities. And Glenn will be talking about both of those. This lectureship occurs every year around the Martin Luther King holiday, and it this year is being renamed the Lenore Hamburger Memorial Lectureship. Most of these lectures, as I mentioned, are recorded on UCSD TV, and you can actually go online and search and find it. It's been an amazing group of speakers over the last 17 years. This is – hopefully you can see them, including Dr. Lenore and Dr. Hamburger, who are the first two inaugural speakers. There was one year that things went a little bit off, but that was just because we didn't have – the speaker didn't show up, so I filled in. So now what I'd like to do is introduce this year's Lenore Hamburger Memorial speaker. It's Dr. Glenn Flores. He is professor of Department of Pediatrics, Clinical Sciences, and Public Health at UT Southwestern. He's also the division chief of General Pediatrics. Glenn attended medical school here in California in UCSF, then completed his residency in pediatrics at Cornell in New York City, and then did fellowship at Yale. He started his faculty career at Boston University and then also moved to the Medical College of Wisconsin before ending up in Dallas back in 2007. His research interest focused on health disparities in children and cover a wide variety of age ranges and disease states. He really is a classic example of really strong outcomes researcher. His research has been funded continuous by NIH and also multiple other foundations, including the Robert Wood Johnson Foundation. He's published over 180 articles and book chapters and given countless lectures all around the world and the country. He's also mentored dozens of trainees. He is perhaps, as I mentioned, one of the most appropriate speakers because he'll be talking about health disparities in kids and also with a good focus on asthma. So please welcome Glenn Flores.
Well, good morning. I want to start by thanking Drs. Hoffman and Resnick and Dr. Haddad for having me come to speak with you today. It's a real honor and pleasure, and also the Lenoir family and the Hamburger family and, of course, UCSD and Rady Children's. So I want to start with an overview of what I'll be talking about today. So the two goals include sharing the findings of the latest national research on racial and ethnic disparities in the health and healthcare of U.S. children, and to present the results of studies demonstrating the successful elimination of racial and ethnic disparities in children. All right, so I'm going to start out with, and the studies I'm going to talk about, we provided as PDF reprints online for you. We didn't want to kill any trees. And the first study is entitled Racial and Ethnic Disparities in Medical and Oral Health, Access to Care and Use of Services in U.S. Children. So as background, racial and ethnic minority children comprise 48% of U.S. children. That's equivalent to 35 million. And census projections indicate that minority children will outnumber white children by 2018, just 3 years from now. From 2000 to 2010, white children in America declined by 4.3 million, whereas Latino and Asian Pacific Islander children increased by 5.5 million. Indeed, all growth in the child population in America from 2000 to 2010 is attributable to population increases in children who are Latino, Asian Pacific Islander, multiracial, or some other race besides white. And in 2011, for the first time ever in our nation's history, minority births at 50.4% outnumbered white births at 49.6%. In California, minority children comprise 74% of children, equivalent to over 6.7 million. And Latinos are the largest racial and ethnic group of children in California, about 52% of the state's children, that's about 4.7 million. Asian Pacific Islanders account for 11% of California children, about 1 million. African American children constitute 6%, or over 521,000. American Indians and Alaskan Natives, about 0.7%, or over 64,000. Multiracial children is a very quickly growing group in the U.S. in general. They're 8% in California, or about 768,000. And white children account for about 26%, or 2.4 million. But really not enough is known about racial and ethnic disparities in children's medical and oral health and health care, especially when you compare them with adults. So our aim in this study was to examine racial and ethnic disparities among U.S. children in medical and oral health, access to health and dental care, and use of health and dental services. So the methods were as follows. The data source is the National Survey of Children's Health, or what we call NSCH. And this is a telephone survey. There's several waves. I'm going to talk about first the 2003 to 2004 wave, which was a national random sample. It's all 50 states and D.C. It's households with children who are 0 to 17 years old. It oversamples households with African-American and Latino children. That's to give it more statistical power. And the parent or guardian most responsible for the child's health care is interviewed. It's a good sample size, over 102,000. Interview completion rate's about 55%, which is real good for these kinds of surveys. And there are adjustments for non-response and non-coverage of households that don't have telephones. And estimates based on the sampling weights that are provided with the survey generalize the entire non-institutionalized population of U.S. children who are 0 to 17 years old. In terms of study variables, disparities in medical and oral health and health care were examined for non-Latino white, Latino, non-Latino African American, Asian Pacific Islander, Native American, and multiracial children. The variables examined included medical and oral health, general health status by parental report, the prevalence of specific chronic conditions, access to health and dental care, and use of health and dental services. In terms of the analyses, multivariable analyses were performed so that we could adjust for the child's age, medical or dental insurance coverage, family income, primary language spoken at home, the number of children and adults in the household, parental employment, and parental educational attainment. So the results were as followed. Let me walk you through this slide. So these are selected characteristics of 0 to 17-year-old U.S. children. Your first column is a characteristic. Then you have the racial and ethnic groups you mentioned, white, Latino, African American, Asian Pacific Islander, Native American, multiracial, and these are either the means or the proportions, and all these comparisons are statistically significant. So you can see, on average, compared to white children, in particular Latinos and multiracial children are a little bit younger, and you can see that those households also tend to have more than three children in the household, particularly Native Americans. And the educational attainment tends to be lower for minority households, particularly among Latinos. No adult in the household with a high school diploma is 2% for whites and 29% for Latinos. In terms of employment, somewhat less employment in some of the minority groups. And then income less than poverty threshold, you can see particularly high among Native American, Latino, and African American households. And then in terms of health insurance, by far, Latinos are most likely to be uninsured, 21% versus 6%, and also Native Americans are high at 16%. Then sporadically insured, that means they had the insurance and then lost it, also particularly high among Native American, Latinos, and African American populations. Then in terms of medical and oral health, you can see the health not being excellent or very good, so suboptimal, about a third of Latino kids and one in five African American kids. The teeth condition not being excellent or very good, particularly high among Latinos, over half of them, and then high 30s for the rest of the groups compared to whites. Overweight or obese, you can see well over half for Native Americans and for African Americans, and close to half for the other minority groups. Limited abilities versus other children of the same age, particularly high for African Americans. Asthma, as we know from other studies, particularly high among African Americans and multiracial kids. Diabetes, particularly high among Native American kids. Emotional, concentration, behavioral, and interpersonal difficulties, particularly high among the African American, multiracial, and Native American groups. Eczema and skin allergies, also somewhat higher for African American kids. And speech problems, a little bit higher for Native Americans, as was hearing and vision problems. In terms of access barriers to care, you can see that minority groups in particular are more likely to have no usual source of medical care, particularly Native American, Latino kids. Unmet medical care needs due to specific reasons, so no health insurance. Interestingly, Asian Pacific Islanders, 100%. Health plan problems, particularly high in multiracial kids, and transportation problems in Native American kids. Any problem getting specialist care, you can see particularly high in Asian Pacific Islander children, but about a third of Latino and Native American kids also reported that, and it was only 21% for white kids. When you look at unmet preventive dental care needs due to specific issues, health plan problems are big for Asian Pacific Islander, transportation problems for Native Americans, and the dentist didn't know how to provide the care was reported for about 25% of Asian Pacific Islander families. Use of medical and dental services, so in terms of no medical visit in the past year, particularly high for Native American and Asian Pacific Islander and Latino kids, at least one ED visit in the past year, much higher for Native American, African American, and multiracial kids. No dental visit in the past year, 30% of Latinos, and close to that for Native American and multiracial kids. No routine preventive dental visit in the past year, much higher for Native American kids, and then didn't get a prescription for needed medication, particularly high for African American kids. So, of course, you can't just look at the differences and say these disparities. You need to adjust for a number of different potential confounders. And we mentioned that we did that, and you can see the list at the bottom. So here and in the slides that follow, in the first column, you're going to see the measure. And then you have the odds ratios and 95% confidence intervals versus white kids for each of the different racial and ethnic groups. And if the 95% CI does enclose one, that means it's statistically significant. So you can see the child's health not being excellent or very good, much higher odds, about double for African-American and Latino children, and also higher odds for multiracial children compared to whites. The teeth condition not being excellent or very good, higher odds for those same three groups. Overweight or obesity, you can see particularly high odds for Native American, African-American, Latino kids. Limited abilities versus other kids, higher odds for African-American kids. Asthma, higher odds for African-American, multiracial, and asthma. And then you can see for diabetes, borderline trend for higher odds for Native American kids, emotional concentration, behavioral or interpersonal difficulties, higher odds for multiracial and African American kids. Same thing for eczema or skin allergies. Speech problems, again, particularly high for African American kids. And then for hearing and vision problems, higher odds for Native American kids. When you look at the odds of being uninsured, particularly high for Native American, Latino, and multiracial kids. No usual source of medical care. All of the minority groups except for Asian Pacific Islander had higher odds, particularly Native American kids. The unmet medical care needs due to specific issues, the health plan problem you see persists for multiracial kids, transportation problems, particularly high for Native Americans, and any problem getting specialist care, triple the odds for Asian Pacific Islander populations and about 1.5 times for Latino populations. In terms of unmet preventive dental care needs due to specific issues, transportation problems, higher odds for Asian Pacific Islander and Native American, and dentists didn't know how to provide care, higher odds for three groups, Asian Pacific Islander, Native American, and African American. And in terms of use of medical and dental services, you see all of the minority groups had much higher odds for no medical visit in the past year after adjustment, at least one ED visit in the past year, higher odds for Native American and African American kids, no dental visit in the past year, higher odds for Native American, multiracial, and African American kids, no routine preventive dental visit in the past year, all of the groups except for Asian Pacific Islanders, and didn't get a prescription for a needed medication, higher odds for African American and Latino kids. And then we did a follow-up study to look at trends over time, and in this recent analysis in 2013, we looked at the disparities trends over time comparing 2003, which I just showed you, to 2007, and that comparison showed that minority children continue to experience multiple disparities in medical and oral health and health care. Most of these disparities persisted over time, so the number of indicators for which at least one racial and ethnic group experienced disparities did not significantly change over that time interval, nor did the total number of specific disparities, which were 46 in the most recent analysis. And although disparities in the use of health services decreased, there were 10 new disparities in 07. So we concluded from this study that minority children experienced multiple disparities in medical and oral health, access to care, and use of services. Certain disparities were found to be particularly marked for specific racial and ethnic groups. Multiracial children experience many disparities, and these disparities persist over time. Implications include greater attention needs to be paid to racial and ethnic disparities in children's medical and dental care, as disparities occur frequently in kids, not just in adults. Greater understanding is required of the causes of these disparities, and effective interventions are needed to reduce and eliminate these disparities in children. So next we said, okay, let's take one specific issue and see if we can figure out the reasons for these disparities. So this study is entitled How Medicaid and CHIP Can Do a Better Job of Insuring Uninsured Children, the Perspectives of Parents of Uninsured Latino Children. It's also available in your electronic reprints online. So just as background, 5.9 million U.S. children, that's 8%, are uninsured. And in California, it's 891,000 children, that's 10%, are uninsured. That's the second highest number of uninsured children of any state. Of course, Texas is first with that, my state. And two-thirds are eligible for, but not enrolled in, the public insurance programs, so Medicaid and CHIP. The children at greatest risk of being uninsured are the poor, so 16% of kids and families with incomes less than 100% of the federal poverty level are uninsured. That compares with 5% of children and families who have higher incomes greater than 300% of the federal poverty level. And undocumented kids, so 37% of undocumented immigrant children are uninsured. That compares with 11% of U.S. citizen children. And as we mentioned, Latinos are the most uninsured racial and ethnic group of children. 12% of Latino children, that's 2.5 million, are uninsured. That compares with 5% of white, 8% of African American, and 8% of Asian Pacific Islander children. And among uninsured children, Latinos actually outnumber all the other racial and ethnic groups, including whites. So we know there are a lot of adverse consequences of having no health insurance. So compared with children who have health insurance, uninsured children are significantly more likely to be in poorer, fairer health, to have less access to health care, to not have a regular source of primary care, to use medical and dental care less often, to have made no medical visit in the past year, to be under-immunized, to make ED visits, to experience avoidable hospitalizations, injury hospitalizations, and adverse outcomes as newborns, and to die in hospitals, intensive care units, and after trauma and coarctation of the aorta. So the research issues when we started our study were, prior to this research, little was known about why parents are unable to obtain health insurance for their uninsured children. So our goals were to determine the reasons why many parents are unable to obtain health insurance for their uninsured children, especially in Latino population, and explore parents' views on how a community-based case manager could assist in the process of insuring the uninsured. So our methods were, we used focus groups. This is qualitative research, which I think is an underutilized approach, and you're seeing it more and more now in medical research. So we did a consecutive series of parents of uninsured children. There were six focus groups, 4 to 8 participants per group. The focus was on Latinos because, as you mentioned, they're the most uninsured racial and ethnic group. Parents were recruited from 2 Boston communities with the highest proportion of uninsured Latino children. So East Boston, where you have 37% of the kids uninsured, Jamaica Plain, 27%. Parents were recruited from supermarkets, bodegas, those are the little corner markets, laundromats, and beauty salons. That's because we wanted to ensure high rates of participation of undocumented immigrants, which is a population that's not always accessible through traditional census block methods. We gave each family a $100 honorarium, free transportation, and on-site daycare. And then we had Medicaid and CHIP representatives provide health insurance to each uninsured child after we finished the focus groups. So the focus group questions were derived from findings of a pilot study and also from the Kaiser Commission on Medicaid and the Uninsured. The questions we asked included, what problems have you had trying to help get health insurance for your child? What have you found to be confusing about getting health insurance for your child? What makes a child eligible for health insurance? What hassles have you experienced in trying to get insurance for your child? And what things could a case manager do that would be helpful in getting your child insured? So in terms of data analysis, each focus group session was audio taped, professionally transcribed. We looked for themes common to all 6 focus groups, and then we created a final taxonomy to summarize the range of obstacles to insuring uninsured children and then the role of case managers. So the results were as follows in terms of the sociodemographics of the focus group participants. There were 31 parents in the 6 focus groups. Mean parental age was 36. Mean age of the child was 9 years. About 2/3 of the parents had never graduated high school. We had the whole spectrum of citizenship, U.S. citizen, no documentation, green card, work permit, and temporary visa. And in terms of the ethnicity and income of the focus group participants, so this is more or less what you see in this northeastern part of the United States, a lot of Dominicans in particular in Boston, Salvadorian, Colombian, Puerto Rican, and Mexican. You see very low median annual family income, $12,000. The range was from nothing to $38,400. Per year, and 81% were under the federal poverty threshold. So parents reported a variety of problems in insuring their uninsured children. So there were eligibility issues. The income was too high or invalid or no Social Security for the child, Social Security number. The parent never applied in some cases. The system problems that included still waiting for more than a month for a decision or paperwork. Unjust denials by the insurance representative. So an unemployed mother was told that she needed pay stubs, and then others were told only employed parents' children qualify for insurance, and then some were just told insurance would be too expensive for you. So parents complained about overly strict regulations and language barriers. So two mothers said, you bring in a pay stub, and they say they have to be recent. If they're from last month, they throw them away. Another mother said, some people get upset because we don't speak English. Parents said sometimes there are too many hassles. They ask too many questions. My mother said, yes, they did ask me too many questions. I said to myself, I did not steal her, my daughter. It takes too long to apply and get decisions, and there's too much paperwork. Many parents don't know about these programs and the eligibility rules, so parents frequently are misinformed about the state rules. Some thought you must be employed. Some thought you must be unemployed. Some believed just having an ill child or one needing medical care would qualify your child for insurance. Many believe that the child and her parent must be a legal resident. At that time, that wasn't true in Massachusetts. Some believe that just getting welfare would disqualify you. The maximum qualifying income cited ranged from less than $4,800 a year to less than $30,000 per year, with most parents citing the lower end. In fact, they all got it wrong. The mass cutoff at that time was 200% of the federal poverty level, so that's $35,000. So there are a lot of system problems that stop parents from insuring their children. So excessive waits to file applications and get a decision. Frequent misinformation from the insurance representatives. The insurance people would lose the applications, and then there are arbitrary and inappropriate suspensions of the insurance. So the system problems they told us included, one mother said, they don't complete the paperwork. When you call on the phone, there's so much confusion, and then they transfer you from one place to another on the phone, and you don't get anything, and you realize you don't have anything, nothing, and they haven't helped you at all. Another said, they said that they'd sent me the copy of the insurance card, but it never arrived. I brought my children to the clinic. My son was sick, and they told me my insurance card was useless. Today, I received a bill for almost $800. A lot of parents cited frustration. So one said, because we're immigrants, they always want to give us less. They don't want to give us anything. Another said, I disagree with not giving medical insurance to illegal residents because if they get sick, they're human beings just like those who are citizens. They work. They're not loads on the government, as they say, because those who are undocumented don't live on welfare. They work. Another said, they always reject you. Sometimes they mistreat you because you're Hispanic and applying for insurance. Another just said, they make it so hard for us. This case manager concept was universally welcomed by parents, so they said it would be great. We need a representative, someone to talk to and give us more ideas. Another said, of course that would be best because we don't speak English. We're not going to know what they're saying to us. It's better to have someone that speaks our language. And this would make it easier for us because we don't even know how to answer. We don't understand the questions they ask us. So we concluded from this study that a variety of problems prevent parents from insuring their uninsured children, including eligibility issues, not applying, unjust denials, and language barriers. Parents frequently don't know about programs and eligibility rules and must cope with many hassles and frustrations. System problems that impede insuring children include excessive waits, frequent misinformation, loss of applications, and arbitrary insurance cancellation. And parents universally were enthusiastic about having a case manager to assist them with insuring their children. Implications include current Medicaid and CHIP outreach enrollment efforts are not effectively reaching the most vulnerable populations. Parents of uninsured children want better information about programs, eligibility, and application processes, and a more efficient, user-friendly system. And alternative outreach strategies, such as case managers, are urgently needed because unused CHIP funds are being taken away and used for other purposes. So we said, okay, we have identified disparities. We understand the reasons. Let's take a shot at developing an intervention and trying to eliminate the disparity. So this study was entitled The Successful Elimination of a Racial and Ethnic Disparity in Children's Healthcare, a randomized controlled trial of the effectiveness of community-based case managers in insuring uninsured Latino children. And again, the reprint is available online. So just some background. In February of 2009, President Obama signed into law the Children's Health Insurance Program Reauthorization Act of 2009, better known as CHIPRA. And that adds $33 billion in federal funds for children's coverage over 4.5 years and aims to cover an additional 4.1 million children by 2013 through Medicaid and CHIP. And under CHIPRA, states are able to strengthen their existing programs, cover additional low-income uninsured children, and increase outreach and enrollment efforts through grants and express lane eligibility. In terms of the research issues on insuring uninsured children, although Medicaid and CHIP outreach and enrollment programs exist, few have been formally evaluated, and prior to our study, there actually were no published randomized controlled trials comparing the effectiveness of various outreach and enrollment programs, so there was a critical need for an innovative, rigorously tested outreach and enrollment intervention. Our goal was to conduct a randomized trial to evaluate whether community-based case managers might be more effective than traditional CHIP and Medicaid outreach and enrollment in insuring uninsured children. The methods were as follows. This was a randomized controlled trial. It was single-blinded in that the outcomes were monitored by a research assistant, unaware of whether the participant was being allocated to the intervention or control group. Couldn't do double-blinding, given that the participants immediately knew whether or not they got a case manager at that time. So uninsured children were recruited at the community sites that we mentioned earlier and randomized to train case managers, that's the intervention, and a control group with no intervention other than what was out there in the state. The setting, again, was supermarkets, bodegas, beauty salons, laundromats, and churches in the two Boston communities we mentioned earlier, East Boston and Jamaica Plain, where we know they have the highest proportion of uninsured kids and Latinos. And subjects in both groups received participation incentives and were contacted monthly by a blinded research assistant to monitor outcomes for a year. So what was the intervention? So case managers were trained bilingual Latina staff from the same communities of the participants who provided information and assistance on eligibility for insurance programs. They filled out and submitted the child's insurance application together with the parent. They expedited final coverage decisions by early and frequent contact with the Medicaid and what was called the Children's Medical Security Plan, that's CMSP. That's the CHIP equivalent in Massachusetts, and that covers Medicaid-eligible kids. At that time, it included non-citizens, and no longer does. The case managers also acted as a family advocate by being a liaison between Medicaid and CMSP programs and the family, and they sought to remedy situations where the children were inappropriately having their coverage discontinued or being told that they were ineligible. The control group received the traditional Medicaid and CHIP outreach enrollment, which in Massachusetts to this day currently consists of direct mailings, press releases, newspaper inserts, health fairs, and door-to-door canvassing, special attempts to reach the Latino communities, such as Spanish radio spots, mini-grants to community organizations, and a toll-free telephone number for applying for health benefits. The main outcome measures we kept simple, so the proportion of children obtaining health insurance, proportion of kids with episodic coverage, so that's getting the insurance but then losing it, the number of days it took from study enrollment to the child getting the coverage, and then the parent's satisfaction with the process of trying to obtain the coverage for the child, whether or not they got the child covered. The results were as followed in terms of enrollment, randomization, follow-up. There were 275 subjects enrolled and randomized, 139 to the community-based case managers, the intervention, 136 in the control group, 18 were lost to follow-up or withdrew. In terms of participating at least one follow-up visit, we had 97% in the intervention group, 90% of the control group, and participating in the final follow-up visit, that's a year later, 72% in the intervention group, 62% in the control group. So in terms of the baseline sociodemographics, this slide shows the characteristic in the first column. You have the means or proportions for the intervention and control group, respectively, in the second and third column. P-values in the final column, and as you like to see in your table one, no significant differences between the two groups after randomization. You can see the mean child age was about 9, equal distribution of the different Latino subgroups. You can see a lot of these were single-parent households, very low median annual household income, about 13 to 14,000, lots of limited English proficiency among the parents, and you can see that there wasn't a lot of high educational attainment, and then a lot of the parents were not U.S. citizens. So what do we find in terms of obtaining health insurance coverage? Well, we found a significantly higher proportion of the case management intervention group obtained health insurance versus the control group at 96% versus 57%. So that eliminated the disparity for Latinos. That brought it way down. The intervention group was more than twice as likely to obtain the insurance coverage as a control group. So the adjusted relative risk was 2.3. And if you like odds ratios better, that was about 8. And that's after we adjusted for relevant confounders, the child's age, the annual combined family income, citizenship, parental employment, and then there was even a state policy change in Medicaid and CHIP, temporary enrollment caps and premium increases, and we adjusted for that. So this slide shows the proportion insured by site and group assignment. Your y-axis, the percent insured, x-axis, the two sites, and then the total sample. You have your orange bars, intervention, and pink control. You can see these are all highly statistically significant. So at the individual sites, you can see that 96% of the intervention group got insured, 55% of the control, second site, 95 versus 63, and overall, 96 versus 57. Then we also looked at this in terms of an adjusted incidence curve. So your y-axis is the percent insured, x-axis time to insurance in days. You have your navy is the intervention group, and your pink is the control group. And you can see that there's a marked difference between the two groups in obtaining insurance coverage that emerges at approximately 30 days and then is sustained throughout. So in terms of coverage continuity and the time interval to obtain coverage, you have your variable in the first column, percent or your mean of the intervention and control groups respectively in the second and third columns, and your p-value in the final column, statistical significance in all of these. So you can see our intervention group much more likely to be continuously insured, 78 versus 30%, much less likely to be sporadically insured, 18 versus 27%, much less likely to be continuously uninsured, 4 versus 43%, and your mean time to insurance, about 88 days for our intervention group, 135 days for the control group. In terms of parental satisfaction with the process of obtaining insurance coverage, that's whether or not the child actually got the coverage, you have your percent on your y-axis. These are the five Likert scale categories. The families could choose very satisfied, satisfied, uncertain, dissatisfied, and very dissatisfied. Orange is intervention group, pink control group, and you can see that the intervention group was much more likely to be very satisfied, 80 versus 29%, and much less likely to be either dissatisfied or very dissatisfied. So we concluded from this study that compared with traditional Medicaid and CHIP outreach and enrollment, community-based case managers were substantially more effective in obtaining health insurance for Latino kids, getting the insurance quicker, continuously insuring them, and achieving high parental satisfaction. Community-based case management was highly effective in ensuring uninsured children documented to be at the greatest risk for continuing to lack insurance coverage for Latinos, poor, and immigrants. And the findings indicate that racial and ethnic disparities can be eliminated using an evidence-based, family-oriented, community-based approach. We also had some nice policy consequences of the study. So we were honored with a congressional research briefing on Capitol Hill in 2005. This prompted the Community Health Workers Act in the U.S. Senate. It ultimately was not funded at the time, but it would have authorized the HHS secretary to award grants to promote positive health behaviors for women and children, especially minority women and children in underserved communities, and permitted funds to be used to support community health workers to do this kind of education and outreach. But the president's CHIPRA legislation included community health workers as a means of outreach and enrollment of uninsured children, in part based on our study. So implications include community-based case management could be an effective means for reducing or eliminating racial and ethnic disparities in insurance coverage. It could potentially serve as a potent economic revitalization force in impoverished communities. By that, I mean employing the community members, such as welfare-to-work participants, as case managers might reduce unemployment and reinvest capital in the community while reducing the number of uninsured children. And we believe it could serve as a national model for insuring uninsured children and adults, given that you have a rigorous evidence base provided by this randomized trial and the potential utility in the spectrum of national health insurance coverage options, including the Affordable Care Act. So our final study is a randomized controlled trial of the effectiveness of parent mentors in improving asthma outcomes in minority children. Also, the reprint is available online. And just as background, asthma disproportionately affects minorities. So only 3% of white children have active asthma versus 6% of African-American kids and 11% of Puerto Rican children. And compared with white asthmatic children, African-American asthmatic children are 3 times more likely to be hospitalized and 5 times more likely to die. But few studies have evaluated interventions to improve asthma outcomes in minority children, and no study until ours had examined the effectiveness of parent mentors. So our aim was to determine whether parent mentors are more effective than traditional asthma care in improving minority children's asthma outcomes. So the methods were as follows. This is another randomized controlled single-blinded trial. The staff assessing the outcomes were blinded to the group allocation. Participants were randomized to a parent mentor intervention plus their traditional asthma care or a control group that only got their traditional asthma care. And participants were recruited from a consecutive series of minority children who were 2 to 18 years old. Eligibility criteria were at that time residing in Milwaukee, being seen for asthma in 2004 to 2007 in either 1 of 4 emergency departments or as the primary reason for hospitalization at a major children's hospital. So what was the parent mentor intervention? Well, intervention families were paired with parent mentors. So these were experienced minority parents of asthmatic children from the same communities as the subjects. The parent mentors received 2.5 days of training and a 73-page manual in English and Spanish, and this was on not just childhood asthma, but also assisting families with unmet needs for health insurance, housing, food, and other issues. And if you'd like to have a look, the parent mentor manual and train-the-trainer CD-ROM are available for free online at our website, and I can also actually give you a free CD-ROM if you like the hard copy. So parent mentors met monthly with up to 10 asthmatic children and their families at community sites, phoned the parents monthly, and made 2 home visits. And what I want to show you, if my video cooperates, is one of these visits.
Hi.
Hello. Hi, you're Shona?
Yes.
Hi, Shona. How are you?
I'm wonderful. How are you doing?
That's good. I'm okay. I'm Natasha. I'm your parent mentor from Parents Help and Parents Fight Asthma.
Oh, it's nice to find
you. I'm the one that called you, so we can set up this home visit for today.
Wonderful. Why don't you go ahead and have a seat?
Thank you. So how have you been, Shona, since I've spoken to you? That's good. And how's Brandon?
He's doing well. He's upstairs sleeping now. He's been doing okay since I visited.
And how have the meds been working?
I guess so far they're doing fine. He's been sleeping a lot. But
What did they exactly give you in the ER?
They gave Brandon albuterol and Pulmicort.
Okay.
And he's supposed to get the Pulmicort only if he has like a reaction or anything like that. So it's just for like emergency.
Okay. Right now he's having a point where he's sick and his asthma is flared. So they will give you an asthma care plan in the ER, and the asthma care plan breaks down what you should do over so many days until you see your primary care physician. Some of the things that we can do, like we have the peak flow meter. And once you see your pediatrician, these numbers, these levels here will be set, these knobs here. This little red button here will move up and down.
Okay.
It'll go up. So wherever they're set to, you'll know what his breathing should be. He'll need to do this daily.
Okay.
And this is just simple. So he would take in a deep breath and preferably have him stand. That way the airway will be open more. And he'll just take a deep breath in, make sure he puts a tight seal around here, this part here.
Okay.
A seal around here, and then he'll blow. And that might even be fun for Brandon.
I know,
so
that
one, right, would not be a problem. Are you having any problems with Brandon taking his meds right now?
So far, he's actually okay with
it. He's doing okay. Well, that's really good. This one here, like I said, albuterol is a rescue medication.
So that gives you an example. So there was, you can see the mother didn't understand Pulmicort, and they resolved that later. And this is just an example of how she's starting to explain the medications. So we looked at 12 outcomes. We looked at asthma, symptom and exacerbation frequency, missed school and parental work due to asthma, asthma ED visits and hospitalizations, parental and child quality of life. So we used the Pediatric Asthma Caregivers Quality of Life Questionnaire, the PACQLQ, and the Pediatric Quality of Life Inventory, version 4.0, PEDSQL. Also parental satisfaction with physicians' asthma care, so that's the Asthma Satisfaction Survey, the Parent Asthma Management Self-Efficacy Scale, PAMSES. We also look at costs and cost-effectiveness this time. So in terms of the analyses, we did intention-to-treat analyses. That's according to where you randomized. But also we did stratified analyses examining outcomes for the high participants in the intervention and also by disease severity, mild versus moderate and severe. And so for high participants, we define that as those who attended at least 25% of the monthly community meetings and completed at least half of the monthly parent-mentor phone interactions. Then we did some fancy statistics, general linear models to examine time trends and generalized estimated equations adjusting for multiple measurements per participant. So these were results. This is the recruitment flow chart. You can see that we assessed 648 for eligibility. 428 were excluded because they didn't meet inclusion criteria, refused participation, or we couldn't contact up and follow up. Randomized 220, 112 to the intervention, 108 to the control group, and you can see our completion rate was about 60% and 59% in each group. So these were the characteristics of the study parents. Your first column, a characteristic, second, the mean or proportion, and you can see that the age is about 32 for the parents. Most of these were mothers. They were about 17% married, living with spouse. Education beyond high school was about a quarter. About 40% were employed full-time. Most were African-American. The remainder were Latino. They had about 13% limited English proficiency. And you can see there was a good amount of poverty, over two-thirds. Low income, about 25%. And 8% were greater than 200% at federal poverty level. And there were no significant intergroup differences in any of the parental features we looked at. In terms of the kids, age was about 7, 44% female. Most of these had primary care providers, so 92%. Only 21%, though, had asthma specialists. And when we asked them the most likely place to be taken for asthma care, 64% said the emergency department. Asthma attacks in the past year, you can see a pretty sick population, about one per month. They missed about 9 school days on average in the past year, 8 parental missed work days. Went to the ED every now and then, about 3 visits per year, and they were hospitalized at a rate about once a year. And again, no significant intergroup differences. So what we found was significant changes in outcomes. So this is the intention to treat analysis. First column is the outcome. Second and third columns are the comparison of the baseline and the endpoint with the 95% confidence intervals. And your p-values are in the final column. You can see that the intervention reduced the rapid breathing episodes, so there was no difference from baseline to endpoint for controls, but intervention group, there was a substantial reduction. Same thing with asthma exacerbations. It was not a statistically significant difference for controls, but intervention groups had a significant reduction. And then we also found that the intervention reduced ED visits only for the intervention group. So then we decided to look at, well, what about among those who particularly participated in the intervention more than those who didn't? So in this slide, same set of columns, but you can see we've also added the low versus high participants. So you can see wheezing episodes, no reduction for controls, no reduction for low participants, but a substantial reduction for the high participants. coughing episodes. Everybody had reductions. Difficulty breathing episodes, you can see that the controls had some reduction, not the low participants, but definitely the high participants. This slide shows the mean number of asthma exacerbations comparing the first and final month. Your y-axis is the mean number of exacerbations. X-axis, those three groups. Your blue is the first month, and your red is the final month. And you can see there wasn't a statistically significant reduction for either the controls or low participation group, but a substantial reduction for the high participation group. Mean number of missed school days comparing the first and final months. You can see there was a reduction for the controls, not for the low participants, and a great reduction for the high participants. Mean number of missed work days, same kind of trend where you see a moderate reduction for the control group, nothing for low participants, and a big reduction for the high participants. And then change in PEDS QL score, so higher is better. You can see that there was an increase for the control groups, not the low participants, and definitely for the high participants. Mean number of asthma ED visits in the first versus final month, you can see that there was no difference for the controls or low participants, but a significant reduction for the high participants. And this is the change in the pediatric asthma caregiver's quality of life scores, the PACQLQ. This first column here is the overall quality of life, and you can see that there was an increase for the controls, but not the other two groups, and then in the activity-related quality of life, there were increases for all three groups, particularly for our high participants. And then this is the parental self-efficacy scales. These are score changes from month one to month 12. You can see the overall score, it wasn't actually statistically significant increase. Can control serious breathing problems at home versus taking the child to the emergency department. You can see that there was a moderate increase for the control group, not for the low participants, but definitely for the high participants. And then knowing when a serious breathing problem can be controlled at home. The only group that improved with that was the high participant group. This slide shows the mean number of asthma exacerbations by follow-up month. You got your y-axis is the mean number of exacerbations, x-axis follow-up month, and you have blue diamonds control, pink square low participation, orange triangle high participation. And the only group with a significant reduction is your high participant group. We looked at other outcomes but didn't see any significant intergroup differences in hospitalization rates or asthma satisfaction survey scores. Looking at the testimony of participants and parent mentors indicated high levels of satisfaction with the intervention. We have another video clip for you.
I think the knowledge is the best thing about the program, is what you learn. I mean, it's not just someone talking, they're answering questions, personal questions that you may have that may not pertain to everyone else. We're actually shown through demonstration different medicines that are used, different machinery that's used to administer the meds.
I've been an active parent mentor since August of last year. I have had, over the past year, about 7 to 8 families. And it's been a learning experience for me because I have 2 children of my own who also have asthma. And learning with my families the different disparities with asthma, the different severities with asthma, and how the different families deal with their asthma has allowed me to learn how I can deal with my own children with asthma. And we kind of learn from each other, so the program has been a great benefit for me.
And it's taught me a lot of things to be aware of, a lot of signs, a lot of symptoms, how to keep them from having a reaction, things of that nature. So if something happens to happen, I know what to do and, you know, what the signs are and how to go about, you know, going from there.
Just the information was so valuable just because my daughter has asthma, so I just learned some of the things that, you know, I should be doing and wasn't doing. So it's just been such a great program to be a part of.
Well, I think it's a great program, and I've been part of it since the beginning. And I've seen a lot of families really, really improve and come a long way with treating their children's asthma. And I think one of the greatest things is we've all gotten to know each other really well, and the families have become pretty close. So it's a great program.
I feel like knowledge is key. If you know about it, then you can do something about it.
The support is what I got the most out of, the support and the answers. That's been very supportive of me. It's been very beneficial. And I actually wish I could stay in longer than a year. So.
All right, so we also looked at the cost of the program. Your first column here is the item. Second column is the average monthly cost per patient. You see, the biggest cost was for personnel. It's about $41 cost per patient per month. Mentor stipends are about $17. One-time supplies, when you average it, less than a dollar. Same thing with the training session, monthly meetings, and the bus tickets. So on average, the cost is only about $60 per patient per month. So then we did a cost-effectiveness analysis. So this is looking at savings and incremental cost-effectiveness ratios. So your first column is a study group, and you have the program cost, hospitalization cost savings, ED cost savings, and then the big thing here in cost-effectiveness research is your ICER. So that stands for the incremental cost-effectiveness ratio. So if you have a negative number, that indicates the intervention actually resulted in a net cost savings. So when you just look at the intervention, you can see the program cost is about $121. There are a lot of hospitalization cost savings, about $361. ED cost savings, about $50. So we actually saved $600 per participant per exacerbation, basically. High participation group, you can see, also had savings across the board, a little less overall. So we concluded from this study that parent mentors are more effective than traditional asthma care, improving several asthma outcomes in minority kids. So reduced wheezing, asthma exacerbations and ED visits, fewer missed days of parental work, improved parental self-efficacy and knowing when a serious breathing problem can be controlled at home. The cost of intervention seems reasonable, averaging about $60 per child per month. The intervention results in a net cost savings of $597 per child, and parent mentors were especially effective, it seems, with the high participants in the intervention. Implications include parent mentors may be a promising means for reducing racial ethnic disparities in asthma and other chronic diseases, and additional intervention benefits include community participation in asthma care, enhanced social support and cultural sensitivity, the relatively low cost, and parent-mentor employment in often economically deprived communities. So in summary, minority children experience multiple disparities in medical and oral health, access to care, and use of services. Certain disparities are particularly marked for specific racial and ethnic groups. Multiracial children experience many of these disparities, and these disparities persist over time. We saw that there are a variety of problems that prevent parents from insuring uninsured kids. These include eligibility issues, not applying, unjust denials, and language barriers. Parents frequently don't know about the programs and their eligibility rules and must cope with many hassles and frustrations. The system problems that impede insuring children can include excessive waits, frequent misinformation, loss of the applications, and arbitrary insurance cancellation, and parents seem universally enthusiastic about having a case manager to assist them. We found that compared with traditional Medicaid and CHIP outreach enrollment, the community-based case managers were substantially more effective in getting health insurance for Latino kids, getting the insurance quicker, continuously insuring them, and achieving high parental satisfaction. Community-based case management was highly effective in insuring just those in uninsured children we know that have the greatest risk, including Latinos and poor and immigrants. And the findings indicate that racial and ethnic disparities can be actually eliminated using evidence-based, family-oriented, community-based approaches. We saw that parent mentors are more effective than traditional asthma care in improving several asthma outcomes in minority kids, so reduced wheezing, asthma exacerbations, and ED visits, fewer missed days of parental work, and improved parental self-efficacy and knowing when a serious breathing problem can be controlled at home. The cost was reasonable, $60 per child per month. It saved money, $597 per patient, and these mentors were especially effective for the high participants with the intervention. And finally, low-cost, cost-effective, community-based interventions do exist that can eliminate children's health and healthcare disparities, while at the same time yielding additional important benefits, which include community participation and empowerment, cost savings, enhanced social support and cultural sensitivity, and employment in often economically deprived communities. Thank you.
We have time for some questions.
That was a really great talk. There's been a lot of work on the community-based case management approach to asthma that's, you know, been over many years, and I really like the parent-mentor intervention. Has anybody looked at combining those two interventions, having parent-mentors sort of as extenders for community-based case managers?
No, I haven't seen them combined. What we've done is that insurance study that I showed you earlier, which was just case managers, we're now doing parent mentors instead and finding that they're extremely successful and they save a lot of money. But yeah, I think ultimately you could have a system where you have a combination of parent mentors, of community health workers, of maybe outreach nurses, healthcare systems, community-based organizations that really run a multidisciplinary effort that I think will have the greatest impact overall. So I think it's a great suggestion.
My other question is a lot of the issues in health disparities seem to be possibly related to health literacy. And is anybody looking at health literacy interventions, maybe in, you know, junior high and high school age children, to see if that improves?
Yeah, so increasingly people are looking at health literacy. There's now an NIH RFA on health literacy. And I think you're pointing out something really key. What we try to do with the parent mentors is attack all of those issues. So the health literacy, the health numeracy, of course, which we're only now starting to understand about. Do people understand what a milliliter is and how to actually measure those out? And we've seen a lot of medical errors around those issues. Language issues are big, and so we try to eliminate those by having parent mentors in the case of Latino parents who are bilingual. And social determinants, so we didn't have people just focusing on a disease. We had them focusing on, do you have health insurance if you have asthma? Do you have a primary care doc? Do you have a specialist? Do you know how to access the healthcare system? A lot of people are saying the problem with the ACA is it gets people insurance and they don't have really medical literacy about, so I have insurance, how do I get a doctor? You know, what do I do when I get the doctor? How do I make sure I get a referral for a specialty issue?
Any other questions? I have a couple questions.
Yeah.
The difference between the low participation and the high participation, was that decided or was that just the way it sort of worked out?
No, so we looked at the attendance and the interaction with the parent mentor, and we looked at different thresholds of cutting off what would be low and what would be high, and that seemed to give us the most yield in terms of the difference.
So it had to do with how well the mentor and the family got together? I mean, it just...
How often they got together physically and also whether they were in regular contact by phone.
And the other question was, you mentioned several times that there were things that have changed in Boston, in like Massachusetts healthcare. Can you just talk about what those things were?
Yeah, so of course, many people view Massachusetts as the leader and the basis for the ACA in terms of reducing the uninsured. But Massachusetts, like all but I think five states, actually still does not insure undocumented immigrant children. There are a few states that do it. And I think that's a big gap in terms of the ACA. And, you know, it's the same thing in my state and the same thing in your state. And, you know, you can spend a little bit now and insure them, or you can spend a lot when they end up going to the ED where they have to be treated for more advanced diseases and be hospitalized. So I think that's a big issue.
Hi, Glenn. Considering the value of the parent mentor, was there any attempt to get a parent mentor clause in the Affordable Care Act for children?
So my understanding is it's definitely in CHIPRA because of our work, but also our work together with, there's a Cochrane database review of community health workers. So they do have community health workers in the ACA, but not specifically parent mentors. So we're hoping that our next study, which shows that parent mentors are really effective in insuring uninsured kids, that will have people thinking about it not just for Medicaid and CHIP, but for the ACA as well. Because we have a lot of...
It seems to be an opportunity at the moment.
Exactly. And we actually saved $11,000 per child when you look at the outcomes in health and health care for the kids who are insured by parent mentors, because the parent mentors are not just insuring them and insuring more of them, but they're also teaching them how to use the system.
All right. Well, I'd like to thank you all for coming. I'll thank Dr. Flores for an excellent talk.
You've been listening to a podcast by University of California Television. For more information about this program or UCTV, visit us online at uctv.tv.